Thanks, Shane. Thank you very much.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Enjoy the show.
Thanks very much, Jimmy. Good afternoon on this Wednesday afternoon. How are you? If you want to contact the programme about anything that's on your mind, 51551 for texts or ray@rte.ie for emails. Did you see the moon, the full moon? I was out this morning and I had to stop and look up. It's just amazing. And I get this sort of freakish existential feeling when I see a full moon, because it looks like a big ball in the sky, which it is. And then you realise that we're on a big ball in space or in the sky, somebody else's sky, and we're just floating around. And gravity is the only thing that's keeping us attached to this ball floating around in space. And then you think to yourself, and then there's 8 billion of us, and then the galaxy is so big and the universe and all that sort of thing. And then you just keep running and you forget about it all. But it's pretty impressive, pretty impressive. So too, as is the number of people who follow Stephen Fry. He has an impressive 12.5 million followers on Twitter. Well, not on Twitter anymore, because he has said goodbye to Twitter. We were talking to Aoife Barry yesterday about where people are going if they're leaving Twitter in protest against Elon Musk and what he's doing with Twitter. He's bought it for $44 billion. You know that by now. Anyway, we're talking about this other thing called Mastodon, which is named after a rock group, I believe. And people are migrating. Isn't that what they do? They migrate from Twitter to Mastodon. And Stephen Fry has done that. Now, he's a heavy hitter when it comes to Twitter. 12.5 million. And he just posted a photograph of the Scrabble letters goodbye. G-O-O-D-B-Y-E. It'll get you 14, just for your information. It'll get you 14 in the game of Scrabble. So if more people like him migrate from Twitter to Mastodon, it does signal danger for Elon Musk and his plans for Twitter. Most of the stuff I'm going to talk to you about in the next 5 minutes is technological. We got an email from Caroline in Wexford. This is sort of a bit of technological and a bit of learning and a bit of teaching and a bit of parenting. She says, can anyone help me with this? Having a teenager myself, I'm very aware that they're growing up in a more techie world. While this is great, for the most part, it's robbed them of a basic life skill. Example, Ray. When you hand in a 50 euro note and 3 euros in coins to pay a bill in the groceries or whatever for 22.21, and the wonderful young person serving you at the cash register just looks at you confused. This has happened to me, Caroline. I know exactly what you're saying. You see, there's an old, that's what you would have done. You would have made it easy for them by giving them the 50 euro and then giving them the 3 euro coins. And you would want 30 euros, you know, in notes back and 79 cent. Now, anybody who's over a certain age will know that. However, they don't. Young people just don't get it. It's so unfair that these kids are trawling through endless pages of algebra, trigonometry and the likes, and yet no one has shouted stop. When you do that to them, they look so confused. Look at you in a confused state. I explained to him how it works and what change I needed, and he was so pleasant, but I felt so sorry for him. He still looked puzzled. Stop, 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 in capitals, says Caroline with an exclamation mark at the end. For God's sake, excuse me, teach them the basics, how to work the old way of dealing with money. It'll stand to them in the future. It's a certain type of logic that they need to know how to tackle. If we want to keep away from a cashless society, we need to arm our children and teenagers now. I worry so much, excuse me there, that's I worry so much about our children and what pressure they're under, and a lot of it is unnecessary. Thanks, Ray, Caroline. There's a lot going on in that email, Caroline. And we probably are heading towards a cashless society. It was sped up, accelerated by COVID. And I don't know, I don't have any cash. And I had this chat we get one takeaway a week. The guy arrived. I says, look, I'm sorry, we've no change in the house. What can we do for a tip? And he said, well, you know, if you remember, you can add it on when you're ordering on the phone. And I said, I never remember. Sorry about that. And he said, joking, he said, the other thing is, like, we can just add it up over a couple of weeks and then you can pay me at the end. And then I said to him, why don't you get one of those swipe card things and I could tip you? But anyway, yeah, we're fast approaching a cashless society. So the question is, I suppose, Caroline, do our children need to be able to do that sort of maths if they're just swiping and swiping and dinging and swiping and dinging? I don't know. But you're right about that, that a lot of the stuff that they learn in school isn't that practical unless you go on to become an engineer or something like that. And that maybe the maths curriculum should be. Although, I've done maths with my teenage daughter, and they call them the word problems. And they're the ones where they have money, or they have meters and building a house or mowing a garden or something like that, or travelling a distance. So they're the ones that are practical. Anyway, what have you to say about Caroline and to Caroline about her little dilemma and the techie world we live in? A victim of the techie world is the traditional wristwatch. Yeah, if you wear a traditional wristwatch, you're probably in the minority now. They're still popular, but smartwatches are beginning to eat into the sales of traditional watches as they become more advanced and feature-rich. Sales of smartwatches are on the rise, and they get a peak every Christmas, don't they? Yeah. While traditional watch sales are on the decline. And this isn't good if you're a jeweller, I suppose, and you sell watches. I was cleaning out something the other day. I have 6 watches at home, traditional watches, and I was wondering what to do with them. You might advise me on that. I was thinking of bringing them all into the place that I bought them. I think I bought most of them in the one shop. It was the Rose Tralee every year. You'd come around and you'd be getting ready for the Rose Tralee, and you have your tux and everything, and you'd think, you look at your watch and goes, that looks a bit haggard. I can't be wearing that on the telly. And you get a new one. That's why I have 6 watches at home in a drawer. Anyway, smartwatches can do amazing stuff now. They can track your fitness activity. You know that, your steps. They can monitor your heart rate. They can even act as a mobile payment device. Caroline won't be too happy to hear that. So people, and just as an example, because we were talking about this morning, and one of the lads upstairs, Brian, was at Bob Dylan the other night, and you might have read it in the paper today, but Bob Dylan insisted that everybody put their mobile phones into a pouch, and then they locked the pouches, and then the staff unlocked the pouches on their way out. So it was a mobile phone-less gig, which I'd be all for. And seemingly people love the experience. The only downside of that was that because people don't wear traditional wristwatches or maybe smartwatches, that nobody could tell the time, because a lot of people refer to their phone to tell the time. So that was another aspect of that. Anyway, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on traditional watches and smartwatches and all that sort of thing. Now, from the very new to the very old, this will be, I suppose, heartening for parents who have children with nits. Because it appears now that nits, as you would expect, are as old as time. Well, at least as old as the alphabet. They've discovered what's believed to be the oldest known sentence written in the earliest alphabet. The inscription on the luxury item reads, it's a luxury item, I'll tell you what the luxury item is in a moment. May this tusk root out the lice of the hair and the beard. So it's a comb, yeah. It's a comb made from tusk. It's about 3.5 centimetres by 2.5 centimetres. It was discovered in Israel in 2017, but the shallow engravings on the surface were only spotted in December of last year, as often happens. Analysis of the markings confirmed the writing to be in an old ancient script from about 3,800 years ago. And it reads, "May this tusk root, we would say comb, out the lice of the hair and the beard." May this get rid of the feckin' lice out of my kid's hair for once and for all. That'd be the modern day inscription of that. That's interesting, isn't it? That's 51551 Ray at RTE.ie. Henry Marsh. You'll know Henry Marsh, you'll know the name. He's a retired neurosurgeon, and he's written 3 books now, all memoirs about his life as a neurosurgeon. Very good writer. He was obviously a very good neurosurgeon, and he's going to be talking to us today. And in the papers today, just on tech as well, in our average life, most of us will have 19 mobile phones, which begs the question, what do we do with the old ones? And I know there was an ad on for Vodafone recently where they were encouraging you to trade in your old one to get money off your new one, which is good. But there's millions. They reckon there's over 6 million mobile phones around the country that aren't being used, in drawers, down behind sofas, up in attics, in sheds. So we're going to ask the question, what should you do with your old mobile phone? And we have somebody on to answer that question, if that's something you want to know about. I used to work in a shop during secondary school in the 90s and never understood when people gave me, for example, 25.25 for something that cost 23.75. It's not something that is lost because of the internet. It comes with ages, says Claire. So if you, 25.25, something that costs 23.75. Oh yeah, so they'd want what? 2.50 back. Yeah, that's what they'd want back, 2.50, I think. Be careful about doing maths live on air. It's very dangerous. Anyway, 51551 radio.rte.ie. I'll tell you about our quiz in a moment, but first, Rufus Wainwright, a beautiful version of a beautiful song. Good afternoon. Nice, Rufus Wainwright. And Across the Universe, of course, a Beatles song. 51551 radio.rte.ie. A few examples of a cashless society. One, I couldn't take part in a lotto syndicate at work as I hadn't change on me. Let me introduce you to Revolut. And two, I give my teenagers cash going to school. I refuse to give them a card like what their friends have. They need to know when the money runs out and be able to count change. Yeah. Unfortunately for a lot of parents, the genie's out of the bottle and they've introduced Revolut into their teenagers' lives. Now, there is a lot of monitoring on Revolut and you can show them there what they've spent. So you have all a record of everything. So in that way, it's good. Nothing to do with age. Or the maths curriculum. The maths curriculum is from 1999, so lots of people well past their teens have been through it. I worked in a shop 20 years ago and always tried to make it easier by asking customers if they wanted to do that, you know, where you'd say, give me the 20 and 50p probably back then, and I'll give you a tenner and 25 or whatever. The look of confusion wasn't age specific. I suppose some people have an aptitude for maths and others don't. Marion has been on from County Clare. I got my first summer job in 1969. It was in the local chipper. We were still in the era of pounds, shillings and pence. The till was ancient. Even in those days, everything had to be added up in your head and only the total clocked in. P.S. I still wear a regular watch. See, it's good doing mental maths. It's good for the brain. I have four traditional watches, says Anthony. They look class compared to those awful looking smart yokes. Wouldn't be without the traditional watch. That's Anthony's opinion. Now, I better tell you about our quiz. We're looking for two people to come on after 4 o'clock. And answer three questions each on bits of songs, news reports, TV shows and movies. And we have a prize. And it is a two-night stay for two people in one of the four-star Ainua Collection hotels. And they're all over the country. There's the Hibernian Hotel in Kilkenny, the Tullamore Court Hotel, the Hillgrove Hotel in Monaghan, Fairways in Dundalk, and any one of the Radisson Blue hotels in Athlone, Cork, Limerick and Sligo. Something for everyone to enjoy, from overnight getaways and spa treatments to elegant afternoon tea or a delicious meal in one of the many restaurants across the Ainua Collection. It's Ainua.ie. Okay, two people after 4 o'clock. Here is today's qualifying question. Dominic West stars as Prince Charles in the fifth season of which TV series airing tonight? Is it The Crown or The Throne? So Dominic West stars as Prince Charles in the fifth season of which TV series airing tonight? Is it The Crown or The Throne? 0818715925. 0818715925. And good luck with that.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or you can send text to 51551. Now, Professor Henry Marsh is a renowned and now retired neurosurgeon. He has spent his life working on people's brains, managing to remove tumours and extending lives. As well as that, he's passed on his skills in countries such as Nepal and Ukraine. And he's written about his life and work with refreshing honesty in the 2014 bestseller Do No Harm. And again in 2017, Admissions, A Life in Brain Surgery. And now his third book, and finally, is in shops. And Professor Marsh joins me on the line from Morgan House in London. Hello, Henry.
Hello, Henry.
Yeah. How are you? So you cycled to the studio?
Yes, I started cycling 50 years ago when I was a medical student and have been doing so ever since.
How is London to cycle around?
It's getting better. When I started doing it 50 years ago, I felt I was just about the only cyclist in London. Now the problem is there are so many other cyclists. Yeah. But no, there are a few separate cycle lanes. It could be a lot better, but it's certainly better than it was.
And how long was your trip today now?
About 55 minutes from Wimbledon.
Okay, right, yeah. So you're nice. Everything's moving. Everything's working.
Yes. Great. Well, more or less. Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And finally, congratulations on the third memoir.
Thank you.
Enjoy is probably not a word I would use to describe it.
Well, I try to make a few jokes.
You do, yes. Very thought provoking. You say this is the book. Sorry, this book is the story of how I become a patient.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's a difficult transition from being professor, surgeon, to becoming just a patient. It's something that you probably haven't come to terms with completely yet, or have you?
No, not really. I mean, it didn't. it wasn't revelatory. I knew throughout my career that being a patient is a humiliating, demeaning, frightening experience. I used to tell my trainees, look, guys, our patients are frightened of us. You know, we think we're with these loving, kind, philanthropic doctors. But as surgeons, especially as brain surgeons, our patients are really very frightened. So that didn't come as a surprise, but it just is very difficult to cross over. And when I go into a hospital now, I feel I shrink. Whereas before, when I strayed into hospitals, I felt, you know, big and important. And that's quite a change.
Is it part of growing into the role of a doctor and then a surgeon that you nearly have to deceive yourself?
Oh, yes, very much so.
You do, right? Okay.
Oh, gosh. But as of any, you have to play a role to a certain extent. And it's particularly difficult in medicine because our patients desperately need to trust us. They don't really know us, and they just have to trust us. And they're very needy. And we feel obliged, almost unconsciously, to fulfill that need. And we have to appear confident and calm and knowledgeable and reassuring. And when you're a young doctor, you often know that you don't know that much. So you're not really as good as the patients want you to be. And, of course, the best way of deceiving other people is to deceive yourself.
Yes. And I read Do No Harm. And of course, when you're dealing with the brain, that's the top of the pyramid, isn't
well,
it?
Well, really? It is in a sense, it's the most dangerous part of surgery. Technically, in terms of the manual skills involved, it's no different from any other branch of surgery. But the problem is it's terribly dangerous because the brain is so fragile. And the brain does not have the same ability to heal in the way that skin, bone and muscle and even liver does. The brain, on the whole, does not recover well from injury, which means every time you operate, you're going to cause some harm. So every operation, you have to justify the harm of surgery by saying the harm of not operating is even greater. And that's where the mistakes come in. The mistakes are all about decision making. The actual operating is easy. People don't believe me when I say that, but it's true. Any experienced surgeon will say the same. The operating is the easy part and the enjoyable part of being a surgeon.
And you talk in all your books about decision making.
Yes.
And you talk about courage versus recklessness. Do you do it or don't you do it?
Yes.
And these are life or death decisions that you have to make.
Yes. And I went into the profession a furiously ambitious individualist. I left it a passionate believer in, well, the word teamwork has been so devalued, I don't like it. But I left it a passionate believer in being a good colleague and having good colleagues. And although you'll still get things wrong, if you have good colleagues, other people are better at seeing my mistakes than I am. And in the ideal situation, you have colleagues who will help you make decisions before you make the wrong one, because they don't have all your emotional biases, thinking how wonderful you are. You know?
Okay, I'm a man of 58, and I've been hearing since I was 50 that I should get a regular, NCT, they call it here, a regular all-over health check. Okay, and you probably would have advised patients over the years to do that.
No, I don't.
Do you not? Oh, you don't?
No,
right.
There's pretty good evidence. Health checks probably do more harm than good.
Do they? Right, there you go.
Because they turn up things that you probably don't need to be treated, but once you know about them. So there's a strong body of opinion that these regular health checks, they're all about hospitals and doctors making money. They're not actually about improving people's health.
And what about early detection, Henry?
Well, yes, but then you see, if you take my cancer, prostate
well, let's
cancer,
get, we've got to it now.
Which I left, I left too late. But if you treated every case of prostate cancer, you'd treat a lot of people unnecessarily, because many people, the cancer never really advances. And it's a cancer you die with rather than from.
Yeah.
And each disease is different. And it is even, you know, there's a lot of argument, even with the breast cancer screening, you might save, I can't remember the figures offhand, you might save, say, a few lives out of 1,000 patients, but you'll give unnecessary damaging treatment to a larger number of patients.
Well, let's talk about you. Let's talk about you then. Let's talk about you then. Okay. So tell people about PSA. That's a measure.
PSA is a protein which is secreted specifically by the prostate gland in small amounts and in large amounts by cancers of the prostate gland.
Right.
So it does give you early warning of prostate cancer. But there's no clear evidence that regular PSA tests in men who are not symptomatic, in other words, who are not having difficulty urinating, there's no clear evidence that actually it helps very much.
Okay.
If you have symptoms, you should get a PSA. And I buried my head in the sand and left it very late. That's a fairly typical thing, I believe, of doctors to do. Disease happens to patients, not to me. I'm a doctor. I'm above it all.
Because you even say in the book that there's scientific research that says that doctors are more likely to present late with cancer diagnosis.
Not scientific research.
No, I mean, sorry.
It's anecdotal.
Okay,
it's anecdotal.
Okay.
I don't know if there's any hard data on that.
Okay.
But certainly in my career, I heard of many such cases, and I fell into exactly the same trap myself.
So even although you recognise the symptoms of what could have been prostate cancer,
I dismissed them and said, oh, well, it's probably just benign. Technically, I knew very well that the symptoms of prostate cancer cannot be differentiated from ordinary benign enlargement of the prostate gland, which happens to many men as they get older. I knew that, but emotionally I didn't want to face up to it. It was pure denial on my part.
And even when you went to a colleague, you say, I don't want to do a PSA.
Yes, exactly.
I don't want to know.
The denial was so deep. Now, the fact of the matter is this is a very typical human reaction. And there's always research being done on the way people find it very hard to admit they might be wrong about all sorts of things.
So what's the safe range for a PSA reading?
I'm not a urologist.
Okay,
I'm not
right.
going to say. What I can tell you
it's
is
single
my
fingers,
PSA
is single fingers.
Single fingers.
Yes.
My PSA of 130. I'm rather perversely proud of the fact only 4% of men with prostate cancer have a PSA that high. Well, it's perverse pride. Yes.
Yeah. Doctors do develop a black sense of humor, don't they?
You're witnessing terrible, depending to some extent on your specialty.
It's a coping mechanism. Yeah. So when you 130 PSA, you knew that was off the scale.
Well, I then Googled it and was horrified when I read. It took me a while to come to terms with it. At the moment, I'm in remission. Statistically, the odds are against my being cured, but it's possible I'll trundle on for quite a few years.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is, I'm now almost 73. I've had a pretty fantastic life. I think of all my poor patients who died who are younger than me. I really have no right to complain. I've got no bucket lists at all. Isn't that a huge privilege? I just want to be alive longer for my family and my wife.
But you've done so much.
In terms of achievements, I've done enough.
Yeah, you've done an awful lot, haven't you?
Yeah. And I'm very lucky, you know. I believe passionately that success is as much about luck as about hard work and talent.
Yeah. But this staring the PSA and terminal sort of prostate cancer in the face, it got you thinking. That's not fair enough
to
say.
It got me thinking.
Yes,
and I had two, when I first had to come to terms with this, I had two very strong emotions. One was blind panic.
Mm.
You know, it was pathetic. And I really would have expected better of myself, having been living with the life and death of my patients for 40 years. I felt I should have been a bit more grown up about it. But at the same time, as I mentioned a moment ago, there was this very strong feeling, well, actually, I've done very well.
Yeah.
I've made it to 70 years old when the diagnosis was made, maybe 71. And even if I knew I only had 6 months left to live, there's nothing I need to do or want to do, which I have to do now.
Okay.
In that sense, I've had a complete life, and I think that's an extraordinary privilege.
So you also thought, and you've mentioned them a couple of times already, about your patients and how you interacted with them.
Yes.
And now that you're at the receiving end, you know. And I suppose just talk about that for a moment, because you know all the tricks in the book. So if somebody's across the way telling you something, you know the code, don't you?
Yes.
So how was that for you?
Well, Interesting is the answer.
Right.
I mean, I went into medicine late. My baby son had a brain tumour when he was 3 months old, although he survived. My wife has quite severe Crohn's disease. So I've had a certain amount of vicarious experiences from the other side of the bed, so to speak. So I didn't, becoming a patient didn't tell me anything very new, but it did make me look back on my career, and I was less confident I'd always done well, put it that way. And I went through an odd time when I didn't know if I'd really terminal metastatic secondary disease or not, which I don't. I have a locally invasive cancer. And I suddenly started remembering all sorts of patients from years ago, which I'd completely forgotten. Patients who'd not done well, not necessarily my fault, but patients certainly where I'd, in a sense, I'd failed. And it was very odd, but I suddenly remembered all these patients. Like, I quote at the beginning of my first book a wonderful quote, which I wish I'd written it myself, by the French surgeon Le Riche, saying, "All surgeons carry within them an inner cemetery, and it's a place to which they have to go from time to time and contemplate their mistakes." And we have that. And in neurosurgery, it's a big cemetery because it's so dangerous. My main concern now, in what time I have left, is trying to teach young doctors and medical students, you know, the psychological aspects of being a surgeon, the difficulty of finding a balance between being kind to patients and being detached. You have to be both. Things like that, I'm very anxious to try to teach people what I've learnt in my life.
Yeah, you say, tell the truth and not deprive hope.
Yes, and I was told that, in fact, by one of my teachers many years ago. Mm. And, of course, that's sometimes incredibly difficult. But on the whole, my experience with the problem, one of the biggest problems of being a doctor is you never get feedback on how you talk to patients. They never ring you up next day and say, "Mr. Marsh, you were crap," or "Mr. Marsh, you were very good." So it's actually very difficult to learn. And people, you know, you'd have to ask my patients what they thought of me. And there are an awful lot of them. And I'm sure you'd find a few didn't get on well with me. I might have been having a bad day. I can remember one or two times I did speak very cruelly and unsympathetically to patients. I'm not quite sure why. So it does make it incredibly difficult.
Yeah, and you write about that young solicitor in the book who questioned
ability. Who questioned me. Yeah. And I found that very hard to cope with. Because in a completely rational world, whenever you go and see a doctor, particularly a surgeon, there are really only two questions to ask. One is, how many of these operations have you done? And what were the results like? And secondly, what would you do if it was you?
Very good question.
And yet, yeah. I was scarcely ever asked these. I was occasionally asked, what would you do if it was you? Which makes sense if you're an older doctor, but not if you're a young surgeon. Oh. But nobody scarcely ever asked me, other than that solicitor, how many of his operations have you done? Because it means, it suggests you don't trust the doctor. And as patients, we're so anxious not to disingratiate ourselves with the doctor. It's a terribly corrupting relationship.
Well, you do have their life in your hands, literally.
Yes, indeed. Yes. Yeah.
So you can understand why they want to stay on your side, so to speak.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And that and power corrupts. Yeah. And doctors easily become too pleased with themselves. And the one thing I felt when I was going through the first few weeks after I was diagnosed with advanced cancer was I could start remembering patients where, frankly, I could have been a bit more sympathetic.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about the brain, if you don't mind. Just because you operated on people and they were just under a local anaesthetic.
Yes, that's right. I pioneered that. Yeah.
So they could talk to you. And the reason behind this was that you could see if you were interfering with anything.
Yes, in particular speech. Yes. I mean, with modern technology, which wasn't available to me when I started doing this 30 years ago, you also would be useful for movement and vision. There are ways getting around that now with an anaesthetized patient. But with speech, the only way you have of knowing which bit of the brain, usually on the left side of the brain, which bit is directly important for speech is by having the patient awake. Okay. And then you give very little stunning microscopic electrical shocks to the surface of the brain. And if that interferes with the patient's speech, you know you've got to avoid that area.
Yeah.
And the problem is that these particular, there's only certain sorts of tumours where this is useful. The tumour actually consists of altered brain tissue. So it looks like the brain.
All right.
And it's actually in the brain. So you don't have a clear border where the tumour starts and the brain stops.
And that is a problem because you want to get as much of that tumour out as you can.
You want to get as much out.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And that's
and when I started
possible.
Doing this 30 years ago, it was actually rather controversial. But I'm happy to say this is now sort of standard practice for dealing with this particular sort of tumour to have the patient awake.
Does the brain move? As in, like, you know...
No, only a little bit. It's breathing, is it? When you breathe in, the brain moves up and down a little bit, but not very much.
Right. That quote from somebody else about cutting, you can't butter with a knife made of butter.
That's right,
you can't cut butter with a knife made of butter.
Yes.
And that's the perennial problem for us as humans when it comes to the brain, because we're using a tool to think about a tool, same tool. Yeah.
Exactly. And there is a limit to how many experiments you can actually do on human beings, you know, on their brains.
But what do you say is going on? How do you explain the brain to your grandchildren? What's going on?
I haven't started doing that yet.
Okay.
I did do some little sort of stop motion movies for one of my granddaughters about bugs during the pandemic.
Hmm.
Well, the answer is it's weird. I mean, the way to some of my public talks, I illustrate the weirdness. Once I was doing an awake operation on the vision areas of the brain, which are at the back, and this is on the left side of the brain, and the left side of the brain sees the right side of the world.
When we move our left hand, it's the right side of the brain.
That's right.
Okay, yeah.
And what when we see the right and the right visual field is in the left side of the brain.
Right.
Nobody knows why evolution has done this, but it's in almost all animals. When I operate, I'll use the past tense because I've stopped operating. I'd have a camera on my microscope and a monitor, so the nurses and my assistants could see what I was doing down the microscope. And with one operation, I had this guy, he was lying on the operating table awake, and he could see the computer monitor. And I said, look, and I pointed to the visual part of the brain. I said, that's the bit of your brain which you're looking at now. And you feel there should be a sort of metaphysical equivalent of acoustic feedback.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
There should be a philosophical explosion, but there isn't.
Right.
And the guy does say, it's crazy. It is, and it's something still absolutely fascinates
me. That is amazing.
The fact that everything we think and feel, as far as I'm concerned, and most scientific people are concerned, is a physical process, and we don't even begin to understand it. And I find that terribly exciting.
And not because we think we're so brilliant, don't we?
Exactly.
Higher thought and sentient beings.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you see, and in neurosurgery, you see many people with brain damage have lost it, you know, and they can lose their moral judgment. They can lose their social sensitivity, particularly to damage to the front part of the brain. So it's very hard not to think, but everything we think and feel is subject to the laws of physics. You know, it's a physical process, electrochemistry. But the amazing fact is, the laws of physics and quantum mechanics and all that has absolutely nothing to say about consciousness. And yet consciousness is obviously the most interesting thing in the world for all of us.
Yes.
It is us.
It is us. And then a sense of self. How do you, Henry Marsh, know you're Henry Marsh?
Well, exactly. How do I know? I mean, it's very sad when you see people who have suffered frontal brain damage. They don't know they've changed. But if you talk sensitively to the family, they'll say, look, you know, this isn't the man I married. He's just different. Yeah. He's no longer very nice.
And the beginning of the book is you going for a brain scan, don't tell me about that yet, because I have to take a quick commercial break, but I want to hear about Henry Marsh going for a brain scan. Okay, quick commercial break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now we're talking to Professor Henry Marsh, a retired neurosurgeon. His new book is called And Finally. And they were looking for healthy people with healthy brains for research, Henry.
Yes. And I thought it'd be amusing to see my own brain, given I've been looking at brain scans all my life. And also, I was thinking of this before I had cancer. I was thinking of writing a third book. I like writing. My first two books are both bestsellers. My publishers were very keen I should write another book. So I thought the starting point could be a bit about the brain. Oh, well, let's look at my own brain. So I had a brain scan, and I was totally shocked by it because it showed a lot of age-related changes. Now, in retrospect, the degree of age-related change was probably normal for my age. A little bit more marked, perhaps, than some. And anyway, we do know you can't really predict from a brain scan what somebody's intellect is like, unless the brain is completely trashed, which mine wasn't. But it was terribly upsetting because it was sort of memento mori. It was me having to face up to the fact I was getting older. And, you know, I was rather in denial about this. Like we all are. And my patients are always, when I pointed out age-related changes on their scans or x-rays, they'd say, "Oh, but Mr. Marsh, I feel so young." I said, "Yeah, you know."
So was it smaller or what?
It was shrunk. It had withered quite a lot. The brain shrinks of age. And there was quite a lot of what's called white matter hyperintensities, which are actually areas of damage to all the fibers connecting the brain, all the brain cells together. I mean, intellectually, my wife assures me I'm still quite clever and I can still write fairly well. So I'm not quite sure what I've lost.
She's biased, of course, Henry.
Well, she is. I know she is biased. She is biased. Yeah. But I'm still able to write, you know, and I've written some quite good articles recently. Yeah. But I don't quite know what I've lost. Mm. Other than what we all find as we get older, it's very difficult to learn a new language. And my ability to do mental arithmetic has slowed down enormously.
Aha. Did your dad have Alzheimer's?
Well, he died profoundly demented at the age of 96, but he had suffered. He was a very keen do-it-yourselfer, which I got the bug from him, although he was a terrible bodger, though I say so.
What's a bodger?
Amateur. He tended up, you know, I found him once repairing, charmingly so, I found him once repairing rust holes in his old Ford Zephyr using polyfiller and kitchen foil, which he then, a bit like Don Quixote, you know, with making his helmet.
Or MacGyver.
And then, of course, as soon as he drove the car, the polyfiller fell out, you know.
That's a great memory.
But he was climbing up ladders in old age, and twice fell and knocked himself unconscious and was in hospital on both occasions. So we do know that head injuries like that do put you much more at risk of dementia as you get older. So that probably was a major contributing factor. But having said that, dementia is essentially an age-related condition. The older you get, the more likely you are to have it.
You say he died 10 years too late, and that sort of brings us into assisted dying.
Yes,
that's right. You've thought about this at length.
I've thought a lot about it before I had cancer myself.
Yeah, and you're trained to treat people. That's what medical doctors are trained to
Well, you're trained to treat people, but treating people, in my opinion, means reducing suffering.
Okay.
Not just prolonging life.
Yeah, well, you see, that's your take on it, but it's not everybody's take on it, is it?
No, it's not. But certainly in England, opinion polls show there's an 80 to 90% majority of people think the law should be changed. And there are so many countries now where assisted dying is legalised. There's absolutely no evidence it's leading to abuse or misuse. You know, this is no longer an evidence-free zone. And it's not about licensing doctors to kill patients. It's about patient autonomy. We should be allowed to choose. In England, by law, I don't know about Ireland, we're allowed to refuse medical treatment, even if it means we're going to die.
Do not resuscitate.
I don't want more chemotherapy.
Yes. Yeah.
And that by law, you have that right to say, I'd prefer to die. But you're not allowed to say when. Or where.
It is different.
And that's very inconsistent.
Yes, but it's different to going into a room and taking the thing that you know is going to kill you. It is different, you know.
It's different, but you have legal safeguards. Yeah. You have independent. You can make the safeguards as strong as you like. It's not suicide on demand in all the jurisdictions where it's permitted. First of all, it's a very small number of people. The largest number of people who opt for it is in Holland, and that's about 4% of deaths. In most countries, less than 1%. Mm. But you have legal safeguards. And the law in England recognises coercive behaviour, but makes no distinction in the Suicide Act between encouraging suicide and assisting it if it's a considered wish. And suicide is not illegal. So why is it illegal to help somebody to do something which is not illegal? And you have to justify that.
The floodgates haven't opened where it has been legalized.
It's quite clear they haven't.
But just to get back to medicine and how it's keeping us alive a lot longer.
Yes.
And lifespan and quality of life are two different things. And,
exactly.
and increasingly people are distinguishing between the two.
Exactly.
Right? Yes. Yeah. And... yeah, this is just talk to me a bit about this quote from the book. No right to die imposes a duty to suffer.
Yes.
Go on.
Well, if you are suffering greatly, I mean this is actually an unusual position. I operate on hundreds of men with prostate cancer because it typically spreads to the spine and causes paralysis, and you can operate to postpone the paralysis, maybe reverse it a bit. But it doesn't actually cure the illness, the disease. And many, if not most of his old men, would have eventually died paralysed in bed, doubly incontinent. Not under my care by that stage, although occasionally I ended up looking after people in this situation. Now, if this happens to me, which is quite possible, I'd like to feel I had some choice in the matter of whether I have to spend the last few weeks or months of my life stuck in a hospital bed, doubly incontinent, knowing it's bound to end in my death anyway, or actually bring my life to a dignified close more quickly. And I don't see why I should be deprived of that right. In the event, I might say, well, I'd rather hang on. I might say, I'm happy lying in bed, doubly incontinent. I don't know. But I don't see why I shouldn't have that right. Mm. And again, there's one of the strong arguments in favour of assisted dying. For instance, and Oregon's had it in America now for, I think, 30 years. There's no evidence it doesn't work well. But a lot of patients, when they enter palliative care, hospice care, express an interest in assisted dying and then don't actually take it up because it gives you the reassurance that if...
Choice. It's about choice.
It's choice. Yeah. And the thought, one of the problems about dying is fear that it might be a very unpleasant process. And it can still be very unpleasant despite good palliative care. And it's very reassuring when you know you're dying that if the end is really going to be very unpleasant, you can have a choice of a quick end. That seems to me basic humanity. And this was widely practiced in the past by doctors, certainly in England, but informally and undercover.
And you wish it's going to be available before you have to...
Well, I hope so. Yes. I have my own suicide kit, as many doctors do.
Go on.
You
mentioned that in the book.
Second book, yeah.
But you mentioned in this book as well.
Yes, I think I probably do. Yes, I can't remember.
Yes.
But, I mean, I don't want to use it. I'd much rather I died at the hand of a friendly colleague with a lethal injection, with my family around me, if I face a particularly grisly end, which I might do.
And how long would it take you to die after that lethal injection?
Well, it depends how you do it. If you use phenobarbital, it's a couple of minutes.
Right, okay.
But because the different jurisdictions where there are different ways of administering assisted dying, some methods take longer than others. In California, the patient has to actually drink a cocktail of drugs. So it means patients who are paralysed can't have it.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's discriminatory.
That's like Dignitas as well. You have to be able to...
Dignitas, yes, I think. Yes, you. Yeah. Yes, but it seems to work.
Listen, before
well.
I let you go, Ukraine. You've had a love affair with Ukraine for how many years now?
30
right.
years.
So you must be very saddened then.
Oh, it's terrible. I was just there 3 weeks ago. In fact, I was there when the Russian missiles arrived. I'd never been under fire before, so that was an interesting experience. No, it is terrible what's happening, absolutely awful. But the Ukrainians they're going to go on fighting. They see no option. The more the Russians bomb them, the angrier and the more determined they become. And they're militarily, obviously, streets ahead of the Russians. They've had the army retrained since 2014. The Russian army is chaotic. And anyway, what are the Russians fighting for? the Ukrainians are fighting for their homeland. Mm. What stronger motivation could you ask?
Well,
for?
It's about ego, isn't it? And power. It's not it them.
It is. I mean, Putin. And imagine a world where if Putin won, or, you know, if people give in to nuclear threats. Well, if you give in to nuclear threats, where does that stop?
Yeah.
You know? It's grotesque. The damage being done is just awful. I didn't have time to visit any hospitals. I was evacuated out to my disgust because of the bombing. But I've seen a lot of pictures of soldiers with the most terrible injuries, and civilians too. Yeah. All this for what? I mean, it's to preserve the messianic Russian kleptocratic regime, which is quite popular with many Russians, of course.
We leave you on a high note. Just a couple of comments from our listeners. Lisa says, very interesting interview. A lot of health professionals are now in this position as they suffer with long COVID. It's very different to be the patient and begin to truly understand that being unwell means that you can't be yourself. That's Lisa. Listening to the surgeon and remembering my son going in for open heart surgery when he was 6 months old. Your son, William, he was 3 months when he had to.
Yes.
Surgeons in Crumlin were amazing, friendly, honest, but detached, which was hard at times, but makes complete sense. Fascinating listening. I've had 2 major neurosurgeries, and this is fascinating to listen. It says, Kleena. And Catherine says, geez, I was having a snooze and woke up to you talking to John Cleese about him performing brain surgery. It took me a few minutes.
Well, I can't help. I've got this frightfully Oxford accent, you know. I'm not going to change it.
He sounds as wonderful as and John Cleese too. Seems like a wonderful man of science, says Catherine. Okay, and finally is the new book from Henry Marsh. Well worth a read. And when you read that, you can read his other 2 memoirs as well.
Great talk. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and we didn't get to talk about the woodwork and the building and all that, but maybe another day. Thanks,
all
Henry.
Right. Okay, Ray. Cheers. Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Grandma, good morning. Thank you very much. 51551 Ray at RTE.ie. Somebody's been on to say, I have many fond memories of working in the ICU at Atkinson Morley's Hospital, where Henry was chief surgeon. Super team who worked hard and went on a yearly Wimbledon crawl. Great place. Closed down now. Great to hear him on the show. And on PSA levels, my late father was diagnosed with prostate cancer at 60. As the years went on, his PSA levels were actually at 10,000. Is that true? It puts Henry's 130 in the halfpenny place. He lived until he was 86 and the cancer was not the cause of his death. There you go. It's a lot of men die with prostate cancer as opposed to from prostate cancer. And we were talking about cash and watches and technology. A few years ago, I worked in a large department store. One day, the tills were offline and the younger girls didn't know what to do. I asked the customers who had cash to pay and I took off the barcodes and took the cash. And when the till was back, oops, something's happened there. Sorry, that jumped. When the tills was back, I just had to ring in all the barcodes and put the cash in. The others were all amazed. Patricia, there you go. And a traditional wristwatch is, done correctly, a piece of craftsmanship. Smartwatches do a completely different job, very well, of course, but are generic and lack character. Apples and oranges, they can't be compared. And on cash, I withdraw cash every week purely for some privacy for both me and my wife and my children. I trust them all implicitly and think we all should have some scope to do things and go places without it being digitally recorded. That is interesting. That is interesting. Now you're mentioned the maths aspect. I'm even more committed, says Stephen. Yeah, because you can trace everything, can't you? My watch is just dinged to tell me that my daughter has gone to McDonald's in Stillorgan. When I lived in Zimbabwe, at a certain time, you could pay with any one of 3 currencies: the Zim dollar, the American dollar, or the South African rand. I was continually shocked by the speed at which the cashiers could convert the money and give you back the correct change in the local currency. I was always too embarrassed to check. Couldn't anyway, but the few times I did, they were correct. I grew up pre-calculator days and I'm usually very fast with sums. Well, like, I'm pretty sure it's not still here, but Henry Marsh will tell you that if you do things over and over again, it develops the part of your brain. It's like doing press-ups and, you know, working on your shoulders. They found that when they did autopsies on dead London taxi drivers, that the part of the brain that deals with spatial things was huge. So if you do maths all the time, it sort of helps your brain. I totally agree with Professor Marsh. My poor mum had a horrendous death after having suffered due to Alzheimer's for the previous 10 years. I wish we had the choice to help her out of her misery as we had the privilege of doing to our beloved dog, who also was in danger of dying without dignity. I remember clearly thinking, I wish we could have done this for mum. That's his bridey, and that's an argument that a lot of people make about that. Now, just to let you know that we've partnered with the 5th annual RTE Radio 1 Folk Awards, which are taking place next Thursday in Vicar Street. It's always a great night celebrating the best of Irish music, and folk is massive. And there's a real resurgence and energy about the folk movement in Ireland at the moment. We've had a lot of the singers and artists who have been nominated on the show over the last couple of years. And for the next 6 shows, we'll be letting you hear the nominees for the Best Original Folk Track. Nominations for Best Original Folk Track. So from tomorrow, we're going to play one track a day on the show. Some tickets are still available for the night itself, which is Thursday, next Thursday, as in tomorrow week in Vicar Street. You can go to Ticketmaster. And Mary Black will be there on the night getting the Lifetime Achievement, and Paddy Maloney will be inducted into the Hall of Fame posthumously, of course. And so we're starting that tomorrow. I'm just looking at the list of people there. Jesse Buckley's in there, Cormac Begley, who we've had on the show, and loads of other people. And one song a day for the next 6 days. That's part of the RTÉ Radio 1 Folk Awards. Now, part of the RTÉ Radio 1 Reeling in the Ears quiz is next. We have 2 quizzers standing by, and we have questions, bits of songs, news reports, TV shows and movies, and a prize, which is a 2-night stay for 2 people in one of the 4-star I Knew a Collection hotels. They're all over the place. Hibernian Hotel Kilkenny, Tullamore Court Hotel, Hillgrove Hotel in Monaghan, the Fairways Dundalk, or any one of the Radisson Blue hotels in Athlone, Cork, Limerick and Sligo. You can go to inua.ie to see what's in store for you there. inua.ie. Hello, Colin Doyle.
Hi Ray, how are you?
Good, you're in Wicklow Town.
Well, yeah, I'm actually in your neck of the woods.
Oh, are you? You're in Kildare?
I'm here in Kilcullen, yeah, on the way home, heading over the gap now.
Oh, yeah. Are you actually in Kilcullen or are you on the motorway?
No, I'm in Kilcullen. Oh. I actually pulled in behind, where is that? There's a pub there with the boxer's arm, is it?
Oh, yes, yeah. What was his name? Come on, lads. That was fascinating. It's in a glass case.
Yeah.
Donnelly. His first name's going to come to me. Somebody will tell me now, Donnelly, because there's... Dan Donnelly, because there's
Dan Donnelly. That's it. Yeah.
Have you ever been to Donnelly's Hollow, Con?
I've never been. No.
It's sort of a little bit of a dip in the Curragh. But anyway,
is that the one with that? There's a little stat. Because I just drove by the Curragh, and there's a little dip, like a little hollow.
That's
and
it.
A little stat. Is that actually? Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
And it's called Donnelly's Hollow because famously he had a big fight there, and people because it's a bit of an amphitheatre. People gathered around to see the fight. Anyway, I'm just telling you this, all of this, because Kildare Town is about 3 miles from there. And and 1 year, it must have been a particularly bad year for the school, we went on our school tour to Donnelly's Hollow.
I never gave a pitch and put in around the
sad, sad. So you're on your way back to Wicklow Town. How long will that take you?
Probably another hour across the gap.
And who's at home when you get there?
Well, Christina, my great wife at home there, she's with the 4 kids. So it was, Anna, who's 6, and Gordy, who's 4, Stan, who's 2, and Jess, who's 1. So, busy house.
Yes, and that was lovely. The great wife, Christina.
she is. No, she's doing an absolute, a blinder at home, minding them all in the house, she does it, to be honest with you.
Great, there must be great energy in that house with 6, 4, 2, and 1.
Yes, there's a lot. When I get home, then from 6:30 to 9:30, just start getting them all down. I know we have a dog here, but I need a sheep dog just to round them up and try to.
You bring the dog with you, Bertie.
The odd time, it depends. If he doesn't want to be traumatised or terrorised by the other two, I sometimes find him in the footwell of the car before he even get I'll hop in. He just wants to come for a day out on the road. So he's with me today. So he bunked off from the house today. So
how are you, Bertie? How's things? You're up against Bridget Forrestal from Callan in County Kilkenny. How are you doing, Bridget?
Hello, Ray. How are you?
Is it Bridget or Bridget?
Bridget,
fine. Okay, no, because there's so many variations of that name in the spelling and the pronunciation, so it's Bridget, fine.
Indeed.
And how do you spell Bridget?
Several ways. 2 ways. B-R-I-G-I-D.
Yes, that's the way you spell it. Yes, okay.
Yeah.
Because you can also spell it B-R-I-D-G-E-T, can't you?
Indeed, yeah.
What are you up to today?
Well, as I said, a researcher, I'm melting wax to make candles because we're beekeepers and... this is the time of year for candle making and for markets.
Wow. So they produce wax?
They do.
Is that a byproduct of the honey or where does it Where is
well,
it?
It's a premium product of the honey. It's a special product in itself because it's so useful for many things, be it candle making, soap making, dubbing, which is what you put in your shoes and,
yes,
and protector.
Yeah.
And for a lot of products like that, candle wax
and
is
when you
brilliant.
Burn a beeswax candle, what's the scent?
It's a lovely soft honey.
Okay.
Smell from it is very nice.
Okay, and where do you
very
sell
soft.
Them? Where do you sell them, Bridget?
We have a few markets here in Mullinahone, Callan, Dunamagan, all these lovely country places, very local markets, and are at home.
And what do you call them? Forestal candles, no?
Tommy and Bees, because Tommy is the beekeeper.
Aha,
and
right.
Although, we're very amateur in this. So
I'm just looking there. That's a lovely ring to it, though. Callan candles.
Callan candles. Well,
yes.
You see, it's awkward enough around here, Ray, because I live in Mullinahone Parish.
Oh, so you're not in Callan?
I'm not in the parish, but I'm 2 miles away, but my parish is actually Mullinahone, and it's cross-border, Tipperary, Kilkenny, so you can imagine the controversy.
Yes. So no offence, but Mullinahone candles doesn't have the same ring to it.
No, it doesn't.
Right, okay, let's get going, or we'll never get this quiz done. So 3 questions each. If you go for a long clip, you get a point. Go for a shorter clip, you get 2 points. And whoever has the most on points at the end is the winner. And if the draw on points, we go to a tiebreak question. Okay, good luck to you both, Colin and Bridget. Right, Colin, I don't know if it's good news or bad news, but the year is 1995.
Yeah, it could be good. Yeah.
27 years ago.
I'm alive.
You were alive. Well, that's a good start. And we're starting at the movies. Do you want to go long or short?
Go short.
Right. This movie about a supernatural board game was a big hit in 1995. Can you name it?
Where's my mom and dad?
We don't know. This house has been empty for years.
And it is.
Is it Jumanji?
It is Jumanji. Robin Williams and Kirsten Dunst. Great, great movie. And you get 2 points. Now, Bridget, under pressure from the get-go, what do you want to do, long or short?
I'll go short.
So it's 1995. This animated movie about an affable ghost was another box office hit from that year. Can you name it?
Then I saw a ghost. It was a real ghost. It was real.
Slow down.
Ghost.
What are you saying?
An affable ghost.
It's Jasper.
Say again?
Jasper.
No. I'm looking out at Grace there. We can't accept it. It's Casper.
Casper.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry about
Casper.
That.
Jasper.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, sorry.
There you go. Now, Colm, music from 1995. Do you want to go long or short?
I'll go short.
Short. Okay, this song was a big hit for an American diva in 1995. Can you name the song or the singer? Who's that?
Mariah Carey.
It is Mariah Carey. 2 points. Oh, I feel so bad about that, Bridget. You were so close. One letter away. Anyway, let's see what you can do on this one. Music from 1995. You sort of have to go short on this.
Okay.
Yeah. This song hit the top of the Irish charts in 1995. Can you name the group or the song? Here's your short clip.
It's not time to make a change. Just relax.
Oops.
Five song.
Is the correct answer Father and Son? Well done. You get 2 points. You're on the scoreboard now, Colm.
Yay!
Yeah, Colm and Bridget. If Colm gets anything from this, Bridget, he's today's winner.
Sure.
However, if he gets nothing from it and you get 2 from yours, we're into a tiebreak situation. Colm, what are you going to do?
I guess I'll go long. Sure, makes sense.
You go long. Okay.
Yeah.
So, in 1995, what did Ireland host for the 3rd time in a row?
President, Lord Mayor, Taoiseach, and in particular, visiting delegates. Radio Telefi Sharon is pleased to welcome you once again to the Point Theatre in Dublin.
Well,
is it Eurovision?
It is. That was Mary Kennedy. You get a point for that. Brings it up to 5. Bridget, you can't catch him. You know that already.
I know. Okay, no worries.
Yeah.
I tell you what we're going to send out, which will be great going to the markets, is the brand new Ray D'Arcy Show Keep Cup.
I can't wait. I'm looking so looking forward, Ray. Thank you.
I'm not convinced by that.
No, it's very good advertising today. Thank you.
Okay, great talking to you, Bridget. Good luck with the candles. Okay, see
you. Thank you. Bye.
Right. Colin, well done.
Oh, that's great. Cheers.
Yeah, so you can go to inua.ie now. And,
great. I can't believe it. Yeah, to be honest, we haven't been away for I don't know how many years.
Yeah, I'm just looking. So, 6421, probably 6 years. Anyway.
Yeah, long, long, long time. Yeah, this is the first phenomenal. No, we're really made up. No, thank you, Mia.
Really appreciate it. Well done, Colin. Yeah, well done. And say hello to Christina and the kids.
I will indeed.
See you, Bertie. Woof, woof. Good luck. See you. Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Ah, but listen to this. And the music, I don't know if it's still the music, but it used to be the music from the Formula One coverage on the BBC. And Formula One have been working really hard over the last number of years to make the sport more accessible to a wider audience. They have greater social media presence from its drivers. And the Netflix series, I don't know if you've seen it, Drive to Survive, has widened its audience, made it bigger and younger. So much so that Caitlin Roach, all the way from Tremore in County Waterford, has joined me in studio to share her love of the circuit and how she ended up in a CNBC documentary, The Shift. How do your friends feel when you say, I'm in a documentary called The Shift?
They thought I was making it up. Like, they're like, of course, that name, like, every Irish person knows it as such a different thing. And I was like, oh my God, like, why would they name it that? After, like, all the possibilities. And I was like, no, that's so embarrassing.
Did you tell them that it means a completely different thing here?
No, I couldn't, because it was too late. Like, the ads were out and everything. I was like, I was like, I would have warned them otherwise. Like, you know, it's not really an appropriate thing.
And The Shift refers to the gear shift, is it?
Shift from business to social media, like that kind of aspect. Yeah, because more and more businesses are using social media to promote their stuff.
So I suppose 10 years ago,
yeah,
you weren't the typical Formula One fan.
Wasn't a fan at all.
No, I know, but who was a fan, do you reckon?
It was mostly just kind of men and like old men. Like, I know that sounds so bad, but it was just... It wasn't a girl sport at all. It wasn't a young person sport. And because 10 years ago, there wasn't much competition going on. It was either Sebastian Vettel winning or Lewis Hamilton. But now with like Netflix, Drive to Survive, like, it's anybody's sport.
Tell people about Drive to Survive.
The way I describe it is like Keeping Up with the Kardashians, but with F1 drivers. Like, there's no better way to put it. It's the most dramatic thing ever. And I love it. Like, the team managers will be fighting with each other and stuff like that. You get to see all the behind scenes and stuff that goes on. And that's what got me into it, because I hadn't a clue. I thought it was cars going around in circles for 2 hours.
Well, it is, essentially.
It is, but yeah. Then you hear about tyre strategy and stuff like that, and there's so many things that can go wrong on the day. It's just a game of pure luck. So, like, Drive to Survive really, like, encapsulates that, and it's just so enthralling. Like, I just, I love it.
Right.
Yeah.
You found your tribe then.
Yeah. All through social media, like, it was just a complete accident. Was scrolling on TikTok. Someone was like, I'm making a group for girls who want to get in the sport, because a lot of guys say you're only in it because the driver's good looking. And I'm like, they're wearing a helmet for 2 hours. Like, you're not seeing a face at all. So it's not really that, like, I'm down bad, but not that bad, you know? So we all got talking. And after a week then, I was like, please go to Silverstone. Like, I really want to go to a race in person. Like, I've been watching it for the last year and so, like, I just want to go. And they were like, yeah, sure. And I had to lie to my mom. I was like, I've known them for months, mom. I always talk about them. And she's like, do you? I was like, yeah. And then it was only a week, so it was a real big gamble.
So these are complete strangers that you know for a
week. Complete strangers from New Zealand, from Canada, from America. And I was like, I could die. Like, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. But I was like, it's worth the chance. Like, you know, just to, like, I was like, worst case, I just ditch them, you know, like, yes. I stay in an Airbnb and I just leave them, you know, like.
So what's what? You booked an Airbnb, but you needed a certain number of people.
Yeah, there was one that had a really nice pool. And okay. I was like, I want to do handstands in that pool. Right. Like, I want to have a laugh with a bunch of girls. And my friends wouldn't be into any of that kind of stuff. So
the handstands or the Formula One?
Formula One, unfortunately. Yes, yeah. We all love a handstand in the pool. But what you call it? They all just said, yeah. I was like, look at this amazing house. It's so close. We just get taxis to and from the track. It's like a festival. Like, you know, you can bring your own drink and stuff. So
you put out the call on social media and then somebody from New Zealand, somebody from America. Yeah. And did they come to Ireland first?
Two of them did. Emily and Jess, they stayed with me for the week. So I knew they were okay. And they weren't like mass murderers or anything like that. So I was like, thank God for that. We went to see Harry Styles and Dermot Kennedy. So they got like a whole like lifetime trip. And hoping that I can go over and see them now sometime soon. Because like, you know, we just stay in each other's houses. So it's so much like cheaper and stuff like that.
So when you went over to Silverstone, did you like, this is your first time. So you had nothing to compare it to. But did you see a lot of people like you?
So many. Like, so many. Like, I couldn't believe it. I thought I would be going into like an old men's kind of club, like, and you know, like, I
just be a little bit more sensitive to me.
Yeah, sorry, just being honest. And then I thought, like, okay, like, you know, like, I'm not rich, like, I don't, like, it's a real like wealthy sport. And I was like, oh god, like, I'm bringing in my own vodka that I got cheap in Tesco and stuff like that. So I was like, oh no, cringing. But it was just all people that just wanted to have fun, you know, were just there for the atmosphere and stuff like that. And
but you did say earlier on that it is just cars going around in circles.
It is. And some races, but then other races, it's just like there's crashes and stuff like that. If it's raining, it's just chaos. There's cars slipping, sliding all over the place, you know.
The
and
pit
like,
stops are like they're
so
exciting.
Essential.
They're exciting.
They're so essential as well, because if you get a slow pit stop of more than 3 seconds, you could be out of the race. Yeah. Like, and you're just waiting to see if they get the front tire on or not, and if there's like kind of like wheel to wheel action and stuff like that.
Wheel to wheel action.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
But the real thing that made it so interesting was the whole Max Verstappen and Lewis Hamilton rivalry. That like blew my mind, because they were on equal points for the last race last year. Like, I was like, you can't
it's
make
like an
that
All-Ireland
up.
Final.
Yeah, thing. I know. Yeah. I wouldn't know much
who
about
won in
them.
The end,
Max Verstappen won. So yeah, and he's already won this season. But the
how much
season,
is he worth now? Would you know?
Oh, a couple billion, yeah. I say. Yeah. Like
and Lewis Hamilton, because he's
same,
been doing for years.
Like he's just, I think eight or seven, like depending on what kind of side you're on.
Do women race?
There is a women's series called the W Series, but that has such like a lack of funding, and they had to cancel the season three races early, so it's already finished in all this year because they don't have the money.
So it's a male dominated
sport. They're trying to bring more female into it, but the bridge from the W Series to Formula 3 and Formula 2, it's just not there because they just don't have the money. It's really like down to wealth at the end of the day.
Is it a waste of money at all?
No, absolutely not. When you see it, like,
it's noisy, isn't it?
It's so noisy. I didn't expect it to be like, because you only see a second and then they're gone and you're like, oh, where are they now? And then you're like, oh, they're back again. But the loudness of the Formula 2 cars, which are like before them, they're like so loud. You'd actually get a headache from them. But that all adds to the atmosphere. And especially when you see like someone sliding off, like they're like, they have their own life in their hands at the end of the day. Like they could easily like have a misfortune of crashing and something serious happen. So when you see them sliding, like you just kind of hold your breath and you're like, oh no, like, and especially when they're overtaken, because that's so dangerous. You're holding your breath again and you're like, I need to breathe, but I can't. Like,
and
I don't
of course
know what's going
to
happen.
You know the personalities now because you've watched the drive to survive. Yeah.
And so I feel like I know him personally. I'm like, oh yeah, that's Daniel Ricciardo. He lives in Australia, but he may as well be from like Ballybricken or somewhere in Waterford. Like the way like I know so much about him, you know? So it's brilliant. Like I feel like they're like friends and stuff, even though they don't know I exist. But I'm like, yeah, we know each other.
So when you're not watching Formula One, you have your own business.
Yeah, Bare Beauty. So it's my own beauty salon down in Tramore. And my poor clients, they have to listen to me talk about F1 while I'm doing their brows and lashes and stuff like that, so they have it the worst.
Yeah, well, you have a lovely enthusiasm.
Yeah,
and you won an award when you were at school. Was it that you designed some
fake tan remover
product?
Yeah.
Where, how did that go?
Oh, it was amazing. So I decided, like, When you're in TY, you go to all these balls and your fake tan is so patchy from week to week. It's chronic and you're seeing ones go around with orange legs. I'm still no better at putting it on. So I was like, right, we need to come up with a thing. So I just put my head down and I came up with a fake tan remover. Unfortunately, it didn't go any further than that year because I had to focus on the leave-in cert and stuff like that. But I got to win. I won in Waterford and then I got to go up to Dublin. Got to stay in the Croke Park Hotel. So I was like, that's lovely. And I won €300 for it. So I was like, brilliant.
You might revisit it.
I might. Everyone says that I should. And I think I will eventually. Just need to kind of think like how to like patent it and stuff like that. Make sure it's safe for people's skin and like shelf life. That was all the kind of complications.
And how's Tramore in the off season? Do you prefer?
I prefer the summer.
Do you?
Like off season, there's nothing going on in Tramore.
But like, you have it back to yourselves, like.
You know, because everything shuts down because they're only there for tourists, you know?
Yeah.
So like, even like we don't have the amusements, we don't even
have
mini golf.
Can't even get fish and chips. You can get fish and chips.
Dooley's still,
still open.
See, there's a bit of controversy now.
Oh, don't, I don't want controversy.
So
controversy.
You can't bring up the, because the best chip.
Okay, no, we won't.
Can't bring it up.
That's another day's conversation.
Personal.
Yes, it is. Caitlin Roach, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your passion for Formula 1
with us. No bother at all.
Thanks, Caitlin. Thank you. That's it from us. Sarah and Cormac are on the way. We are back tomorrow. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday evening.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.